Fascinating story here with Tracy Toyman as we talk about her work, Clock Shavings, Templars, Evil. She was in the pits of hell, for crying out loud. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Tracy Toyman with us, of course. Tracy, as we get into this, a lot of questions I want to ask you about the Knights Templar, and we'll take questions this hour. But so your husband made this huge Ouija board, and you participated.
Yeah, well, I went down to the Kinko's with him and had it printed out, and then we started using it. We had it laminated and started using it. And what I found out later is that the arrangement of the alphabet, which had been inspired by the spirits we were talking to, specifically Baphomet, turns out that this is a cipher that is associated with Baphomet, which I didn't know at the time. It's called the Atbash cipher. And some of the scholars that came before us have suggested that this was used by the Knights Templar. And when you put the word Baphomet through this cipher in Aramaic, what comes out is Sophia. This is a fact that was actually referenced in the book, The Da Vinci Code, where one of the characters is named Sophia, and they bring this subject.
Right.
The fact that when you put Baphomet through the cipher, you get Sophia, which means divine wisdom. And interestingly, okay, there's a church in Istanbul called the Church of the Holy Wisdom, Sophia.
It's an old church.
It's a lovely church. And, okay, when we asked Baphomet, what are you? You know, physically, what are you? And what were you to the Templars? Because the story is that the Templars worshipped this idol called Baphomet, which is described as a head or a skull of some sort. And he answered, yes, it's a head. And we asked, whose head? And he said, John the Baptist. And in fact, this is what a lot of people have said, that maybe this was the severed head of John the Baptist. And of course, John the Baptist is their patron saint for the Templars. And here's the interesting thing. Okay, so we asked, well, where is this head now? The head of Baphomet. We were asking the spirit of Baphomet, where's the head? He says, Istanbul. And it took me years to finally look it up. And sure enough, there is a relic that's labeled the skull of John the Baptist. And it's actually in that church, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, Sophia, in Istanbul.
Amazing. Now, we've got an email in from one of our listeners. Wanted to know, with regards to the Knights Templar, if you know what they might have found under the Temple Mount when they were excavating back in the 1100 time period to 1128.
Well, of course, I don't know for sure, but I can tell you what Baphomet told us, which is he said it was the Ark of the Covenant. And he said that there was more than one, and that the Templars squirreled it away, and that these things are still around. So that's what he said. Because we weren't sure if maybe the skull was the treasure, but in fact, he indicated that that's a separate thing and that it was actually the Ark of the Covenant that they found.
Huh.
Which, and you know, the Ark of the Covenant is a divination device as well. I mean...
Yes, of course. And we hear it could be in a church in Ethiopia.
Yeah, and you know how it worked. They had something called the breastplate of judgment that the priests would wear, and it had all these different crystals on it. And each type of crystal was associated with one of the tribes of Israel. And the crystals would light up in a certain way when they were doing ceremonies in front of the ark, and that was God's way of communicating to them. And they had a whole system of what the messages meant. So this is a type of divination called lithomancy, where you use stones or crystals that light up in certain ways. And so what I'm saying, why I bring that up is just, you know, when people criticize me basically for talking to spirits and taking spiritual matters into my own hands and trying to explore the ether myself, well, you know, this is the way it's always been done, actually. People not only communicate to God through prayers and in their minds, but they also actually use divinatory devices to do it. So I really think that divination is a long-lost art. It's something that has been demonized today. And of course, you don't have to use it to talk to demons like I did. You could do all sorts of things with it. But people are just so afraid now of this subject. But I really think this is the way to get answers, you know, from beyond your own mind, you know, sometimes when you're trying to figure something out on your own, you don't have enough information on your own.
But
so you have to look beyond, you know?
Trace, are people criticizing you because you talk to spirits or because you talk to what could be devilish spirits?
Well, both. I mean, basically, I've gotten both types of criticism. I mean, so, sure, I get people wondering, well, why didn't I use the Ouija board to talk to God? Well, we did actually talk to Jesus for a little while.
What did he say?
Well, he said similar things, actually, because, you know, I didn't just dial him up and ask about anything. I told you, you know, it's a laborious process using the board. It takes a lot of energy. You get tired at the end. So the reason why I'm talking to these spirits and why I keep talking about the same subjects with them is because I'm continuing the conversation. So when I talked to Jesus, I was continuing the conversation we had been having with Baphomet. I was just trying to get another angle on the same subjects about these treasures, the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant. And he did actually tell us a little bit about the Ark.
What did he say?
Okay. The Ark is a larger concept than just the Ark of the Covenant you read about in the Bible. He described it basically, he said this term, one box of things. He said that there's this treasure, a box that contains this substance that has some sort of godlike power, essentially. And it was part of this whole story that Cain had started telling us. He told us about how the fall happened in the Garden of Eden. He described it as this war between Cain, who was supposed to be the heir to the throne of Adam. And then he said there were Cain's children trying to rebel against his kingdom and take the throne of Adam. And the sort of the throne, the what you would call the thing that gives the king, the throne of Adam, its power, was described as being this ark, the one box of things that it contains this alchemical transformative power. And so whoever has the ark has the power and is the king. So that's what he described the ark as.
All right, let's take some calls here for you, Tracy. We'll pick it up by going to Spokane, Washington first, west of the Rockies. Anthony is with us. Anthony, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, this is in reference to that anecdote about the witches and the clock shavings. When the Swedish witches spoke of their aspiration to, in quotes, never again return to heaven, unquote, were they alluding to a pre-birth existence and a desire to opt out of coerced or involuntary reincarnation?
Well, that would be something. I mean, the way the book tells it, it just seems like they were selling their soul to the goat god and forgoing their heavenly rewards, basically. You know, we're talking about Europe, you know, having pagan roots, but having been converted to Christianity for some time. The witches, I would say, at that point, weren't Satan worshippers the way we think of it now. However, they were beginning to take on the anti-establishment pose, I guess. You know, they were continuing pre-Christian rites, but because they were under Christian hegemony, they had sort of taken on the role of the rebel. And so the beginnings of satanic imagery were starting with the Swedish witches. And I would say that that's why some of the old witchcraft covens had such initiation rites, where you would actually have to dismiss and forego your Christian faith and your reward in heaven in order to join the coven. This is something that the Knights Templar were said to have done also. They actually, supposedly during their rituals, you had to spit on the cross or trample on it and say that you renounced Jesus before you would be inducted into the mysteries of Baphomet.
At any point, were you involved in a scary situation that you didn't think you were going to get out of because of what you did involved with Baphomet?
Well, I would say there was a moment where I was afraid that I had made oaths, you know, to Baphomet and I agreed to continue running this order, the Ordo Lapsus et Exilis. And also, I guess the part that bothered me most was that we had members who had joined as well and had actually made blood oaths, had cut themselves with razors and signed their name on parchment, basically pledging loyalty to our order. And, you know, I felt the weight, the spiritual weight of that, that I didn't, I had these people basically giving me their loyalty, and on top of me, there's Baphomet, you know, as sort of the head of the order, and that I didn't even know what I had brought them into. You know, I had forced them or encouraged them to give themselves basically to us, and we didn't know what direction we were going on. So it wasn't really that I felt like something bad was going to happen to me, but I just felt the spiritual weight of that and the oaths that I had encouraged people to take. And I thought, you know, if I don't know where I'm going with this, I shouldn't encourage other people to go with me. So that's really why I dissolved the order at that point. But
good move.
You know, yeah, it was nothing that scary happened.
Jethro in Houston, Texas, first time caller. Jethro, you're on with Tracy. Go ahead.
Howdy, how you doing tonight?
Good, Jethro.
Hey.
Hey, my name is Reverend Thompson. I'm with the New Ida Church down here in Houston, Texas. You know, your name's Katie?
Tracy.
Tracy.
All right. You know, I was just flipping through the channels. I usually listen to Guns Over Texas and things like that, but I heard you and I felt like there was a presence there with you. Like, it's almost as though something was following you, and I usually don't get these jeebus out of nowhere. And so I was wondering if you'd say a prayer with me.
Well, we're not going to say a prayer on the air, Reverend. Sorry. We don't have that kind of time.
Thank you, though.
It was worth the effort.
No, I wouldn't be surprised at that. I mean, I know that I'm surrounded by this energy all the time still, and that's probably why it's so easy for me to have these conversations on the board again. You know, it's never really left me. You know, I feel like I'm a walking haunted house in a way.
Well, I think you are. You've dabbled with some of the strangest things.
But, you know, it has been fruitful for me. I mean, I think that this is the dirty little secret, basically, about poetic inspiration. In fact, Jean Cocteau, in his own films, has an allegory about this. He made this film called Orpheus. And in this film, there's this poet who's looking for the source of his next inspiration. And he stumbles across this radio station that he hears these weird messages from. He starts writing them down as poems. It turns out the radio station is coming from Hades, and he ends up having to go down there, just like the Greek myth of Orpheus. He has to go down into Hades to rescue his wife, who died, and he ends up falling in love with death, the personification of death. But basically, what that film was saying, and a lot of other things that Cocteau wrote were saying, is that poetic inspiration frequently does come from the underworld, or I would say the other world, and what sort of value judgment you place on that is a human thing, but we can just call it the underworld or the other world. There are entities over there that we can communicate with that you could inspire not only ideas for research, which is what I've been doing, but they could inspire a song or a movie. And sure. I think that this is really the source of where a lot of that stuff comes from. And a lot of people who utilize it don't want to tell anyone because they get attacked for it, basically. But it's always been there. And even my husband, who's a Muslim, once told me that that he was taught by one of his teachers that actually, you know what, a lot of the poetic inspiration really comes from the jinn, which is, you know, their word for the fallen angels. And that's where poets get their ideas from. And another guy, Robert Graves, who wrote The White Goddess, which is this classic book about poetry and the myths that inspire poetry, he said the same thing. He said there's basically this witch, this evil goddess that poets fall in love with, and then they write their poems from her inspiration. She's the muse, but they also do it under her command, and they're like slaves to her. And I think that's really the truth, is that, you know, if you're a creative person, you may say that, you know, it's God who gives it to you, or God allows it. And certainly everything comes from God, ultimately. God is in control of everything. But I think that the source for a lot of creative ideas really is these demons who, you know, the word demon really just means intelligence.
Well, I've got to tell you, though, Tracy, I mean, I think you're a nice person. You really are. You're a great author. But I'm baffled why you dabble with the dark side.
Well, like I said, I mean, I started off with this Holy Grail research, and this is where it led me. And honestly, that's where it would have led, because that's, you know, that's where this stuff comes from. The Holy Grail story is totally intertwined with the history of the Knights Templar. Knights Templar got their inspiration from Baphomet. The Holy Grail story goes right back to the fallen angels, which is what I was just describing. So, I mean, you can't look into that subject without touching upon the infernal. And, you know, I just decided to get my information directly from the source. And I say that that's why I think my books have gone further in explaining those mysteries than anyone else's, is because I actually cut through a lot of the allegory and was able to elucidate what these esoteric concepts are actually about. It's really the symbolism used by the fallen angels to communicate to humans and to really what they are doing. And this may scare you a little bit. I think that they're trying to entice human beings to let them out of the pit.
Oh, you're probably right there.
That's what the whole thing. Okay. You mentioned at the beginning how the board was kind of a portal for us.
Right. And anybody, I think.
A lot of people describe it as a portal. I hadn't thought of it that way. I kind of thought that was silly for a long time. And only recently did I realize how it could act as a portal. The board that we have, which was designed by Baphomet, resembles a Masonic tracing board more than anything else, which, again, we didn't realize until we'd been using it for years. But basically, it looks just like these diagrams that Freemasons are given when they're being inducted into each grade. They'll be giving a tracing board that has all these symbols on it, and it always takes the form where it kind of resembles the lodge itself. The lodge ritual room really is a portal. When you open a ritual in a Masonic lodge, you have to do this this activity, which is called circumambulation.
Yeah.
You go around in a circle to stir up the energies, and you also open the four watchtowers, the four cardinal points of the compass, and you basically call up the spiritual leaders of those four corners, and you open up a portal to the other world. And when you're doing the ritual, your chamber is basically not on Earth anymore. It's been opened so that it's actually in the other world while you're doing it. Well, I didn't realize until recently that actually our Ouija board has the same function. And we only realized that a few months ago we were talking to Kane, and he starts doing this stuff. He starts going around in a circle around the letters, circumambulating, and then he started visiting the four corners in a very specific way. And eventually I just said, are you trying to open a portal? Are you trying to open the lodge here? And he admitted it. And then he just started trying to do it faster and faster because he knew I was onto him. Basically, I think there's very low risk of a demon just coming out of a Ouija board and attacking you all of a sudden. But if they go through the right process, they might actually be able to use the Ouija board.
They could. Stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with Tracy in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, I invite you all to take a peek of our television program, Beyond Belief. You can do that by, of course, going to the link at coasttocoastam.com or simply diving up this website, www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Tracy's with us. Twyman and her book, of course, Clock Shavings. Where do we get the book, Tracy?
Well, it's on Amazon, and that's the place to go.
That's the place.
Yeah. Did I don't think I mentioned yet about the chess game.
What chess game?
Okay. This is one of the coolest things we got.
Oh, really? A chess game. Okay. I play that once in a while. Not very good at it, but I do.
I'm
play.
Not very good at it either, actually. I'm terrible. But we're asking Kane, and then Baphomet also later, about the origins of chess. This had to do with some research that I was doing at the time. And Kane told us, actually, that the game of chess is based on this earlier game he called it Ageio, A-G-E-I-O. And he said that this was basically a ritual game, not a competitive game, that the white team always wins. And basically he said that it's based on this story of what happened to him and his children, the war that they had that resulted in what he called the fall of Eden, or also he said it was the same as the fall of Atlantis. He said that Eden was really a kingdom, and you know there was this war, as I said, over the throne of Adam, and when the characters that were actually his children were rebelling against him, they had this war. He said it was fought with swords and axes. But ultimately, at the end, he said he became so disgusted with his children rebelling against him that he actually did some alchemical or magical ritual.
Uh-oh.
That created the flood, and that most of Eden was submerged under the waters at that point, and it was after that that he was put into the pit, basically, by God. But he said that there was this supernal Eden that survived, and that's where the Tree of Life is and the Ark, the treasure that I was talking about. But yeah, he said that the game of Ageio is the source of chess. We asked him, where was chess invented? And he said, Afghanistan. And at the time, I didn't know there was any truth to that, but after I researched it, it turned out that Afghanistan is one of the candidates, basically, for where chess originated. And he told us, we brought out a chessboard, and he started giving us chess moves and instructions on the Ouija board about how to play the original game, Ageio. And we actually played it with him at one point. He played a whole game with us. And the way he described it, he said that the pieces would move on the grid lines instead of in the actual boxes. He called it the points of intersection are where the pieces are supposed to stand. And everything about the way he described the original game of chess, or Ageio, matches up with what I found out later from doing research. It matches up a lot with what's called Chinese chess, which is one of the earlier versions of chess that is known historically. So the amazing thing is basically everything he said about the origins of chess matches up with the research.
Well, it's accurate.
We're able to do.
Interesting. Carlos is in Carson, California. Carlos, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Ms. Twyman and George. Question.
Sure.
Prince William, he became the 1,000th member of the Order of the Garter, a very prestigious organization.
That was
born in 1348, I believe, the same year the Black Death occurred. But on top of that, Benjamin Cream, an occultist, forecasted the birth of Maitreya in 1982, and Prince William was born on the summer solstice in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's going to go on to play a major role in world affairs. My question is he the Antichrist?
What did you say your name was, sir?
Carlos is his name.
Carlos from Carson.
Okay. Well, I have heard that, and I have, in fact, theorized that at one point. Friend of mine, Clyde Lewis, and I, we wrote an ebook that was out for a while. It was actually speculating on that. Is Prince William the Antichrist? And I'm not sure. I think he has there's a good chance that maybe if someone was going to fulfill that role, that it might be him. And one of the things I wrote about on my website a few years ago was this thing that they call the Kosmani pavement. It was actually this the floor of, what was it, Westminster Abbey has this design on it, and it was covered up by a carpet until recently. They removed it so they could have the wedding of William and Kate. And the tiles on this floor were actually laid out according to a code. The code, just to make a long story short, it tells you, it has basically an allegory that tells you when the world is going to end. And it has to do with how long these certain animals live. When you add them all together, then it tells you how much longer until the end of the world. And it also indicates that the symbolism that's on this pavement indicates that the king of the world is going to be crowned here. So when I was writing with Clyde Lewis that book about Prince William being the Antichrist, possibly. I brought this up, that it is strange that he's being married on this pavement that has this coding in it about the Lord of the Earth and then the end of the world. So it's quite possible that maybe that presages or forebodes something.
Do you think that with everything that you've done to date, tapping into the dark side and everything else is going to have some effect on you and come back to you?
Well, it's had some effect on my life the entire time, really. I mean, it's been, well, like I said, the source of a lot of ideas. And I think that also there's been metaphysically some influence on my life, coincidences, things that happen, mainly in my favor, actually. You know, it's I think it's been helpful in my career. And it's hard to describe, but basically there are people and opportunities that have come my way that I kind of think were arranged by these spirits. Now, if it's going to come back to bite me, that's the question that I don't know.
Let's hope not.
But if it were to happen, we're talking about the afterlife. We're talking about whether I go to heaven or not. And, you know, I sort of feel like that's between me and God. And, you know, I'm hoping for the best there. When I started this off, I didn't have any intentions, basically, of, you know, maligning God or putting myself at variance with God's wishes.
I don't think so.
And I hope that it works out well. I'm not sure.
Would you have prayed with the Reverend there had I let him say his prayer?
Well, no, probably not. Here's why. I like to pray. I do pray. But I want to know what I'm praying first. And I don't like to, you know, when I go to church, for instance, which sometimes happens, I usually don't participate in the prayer just because I don't want to just put my name, you know, at the bottom of whatever they say.
Right, and I didn't want to have him put you on the spot.
Yeah,
I didn't want to do that to you.
So that was good.
East of the Rockies, Colin is with us in Baltimore, Maryland. Hello, Colin, go ahead.
How you doing, sir? Yeah, is this George Norton?
It sure is.
How you doing, man? Yeah, awesome fan, man. Big fan.
Thank you, Colin.
I just had a little question about the Freemasons and how I saw one of their Bibles. They, I guess they changed their Bible a little bit to maybe put in Egyptian gods such as Ra, a few others. And I know she said she knew something about the Freemasons and how what would they see Jesus as? Because I know they're searching for the light, as they say.
What say you there, Tracy? What do you think?
Sorry, you're asking me what the Freemasons think about Jesus?
Yes. I mean, why would they have changed their Bible with Egyptian gods at the back of the Bible if, you know, they don't think that's the true word of God or Jesus is the true God?
You know, I don't know what sort of planning or motives went into the editing and preparation of the Masonic Bible. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of different versions or presentations of the Bible, depending on, you know, which group put it out. So, but, you know, I generally have a favorable view of the Freemasons, and not having anything to do with Baphomet, really, but just because I think that they historically have been responsible for helping to bring in sort of Enlightenment philosophy and democracy and a lot of the modern ideas that we have now really help to sort of put to bed the era of monarchy and despotism that used to exist, you know, before the French Revolution and the American Revolution. Freemasons had a lot to do with that stuff. And I think in general, they have good principles. I do think that they basically are continuing, at least on a spiritual level, the work that the Knights Templar started. And I do think that they have Baphomet as the outer head, the spiritual head of their order. But I would say that the vast majority of members probably don't know that and wouldn't take it seriously. A lot of them would even argue with me. And then the ones that are well-versed in esoterica, those are the ones that become my friends and my fans and that I talk to a lot. So Freemasons that know really a lot about the esoteric history of their order, they know that it does connect to ritual magic and alchemy and ultimately Baphomet and the Knights Templar. But it's hard to, I guess, for a lot of people to understand, but it's not, I don't think they have evil motives at all. And I don't think that necessarily just because they're connected to Baphomet, that means that they're evil. He is sort of a spirit that you would turn to for information about alchemy and ritual magic, transformation, how to affect reality through ritual. And he's also, he's always been sort of the patron of these fraternal orders, the sort that you have with Freemasonry. I think that that a lot of modern fraternal orders, particularly the ones that have to do with Western occultism, you're going to find that Baphomet is basically the outer head or the spiritual inspiration for that order.
Okay, we go to Charles now, Eureka Springs, Arkansas. Wildcard time. Go ahead, Charles.
Yeah, Judge. Thank you for taking my call. And Tracy,
yeah.
I have a unbelievable thing. George may know of this. I gave him some paperwork in Rogers, Arkansas, and I have paperwork with Ed Dames. And no response, but maybe you can line me up with some Templars that may have. I have knowledge of a trip to Nova Scotia by the Templars, and they left a deposit on an island up there. I have the three locations, three professional map dowsers, and my neighbor Dows location. Did they make a trip in 1445? Of that area with treasure that you know of?
I think that the Templars were involved in sort of the pre-Columbus explorations and that they had knowledge of the New World. I've read the same stories you have about Prince Henry the Navigator connected to the Templars, having explored the East Coast before Columbus, and that there's supposedly a treasure at Oak Island that may connect to the Templars.
Yeah.
I think that's quite possible. Like I said, I think that they had connection to the other side. They were getting information that other people didn't have access to. And so the fact that they may have been told about the existence of the New World doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, he's got some good documents. I saw some of the things that he was working on, Charles here. So amazing. What's your passion, Tracy? What keeps pushing you and driving you?
Well, curiosity, really, and you know, I think I've figured out so much really about the esoteric side of history and all the things that I've written about, even though they're quite different subjects. There's really sort of a line of continuity between all of them, and so it's like this thread. I just keep having to pull on it, and it keeps unraveling, and more realization and wisdom comes my way, and I just realized that the world is so much more complex and so much more interesting even than I ever thought. And it just never gets boring. It keeps getting more and more interesting. So basically, yeah, it's just my curiosity keeps me going.
Robert's in San Diego, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, I had experience with Ouija boards when I was a teenager, and I kind of remember it being really dangerous and a lot of people cautioning me against that, and so I was just kind of wondering, like, what your advice would be when you do that, because I also read that you, you know, had some consequences yourself because there was the murder of Nicholas Devere and then the suicide of your husband.
Well, I first of all, Nicholas Devere, who's a fellow that I used to write and do some work with, he died of a heart attack. The stories about him being murdered are false, being circulated by a friend of his that basically wants a lot of attention. So Nicholas Devere was not murdered. He was old and had diseases, and it's not surprising that he died of a heart attack, you know? I wasn't surprised. As for the suicide of my husband, Brian, who I did a lot of this Ouija board work with in the beginning, yes, that was very sad, but that, again, had nothing to do with the Ouija boards. It had to do with personal issues in his own life and in our life.
Yeah, I you know, it's something that you probably never forget, Tracy.
No, certainly not. I mean, I have to admit, at the time, of course, when, you know, you start blaming yourself someone kills themselves, I thought about that and so many other things. Could I have done this and caused it? Could I have done that? But ultimately, no. I mean, the reasons why he killed himself are obvious and plain if you knew the personal story there. So, I mean, you're talking about can Ouija boards have a negative impact, and it really has nothing to do with the board. It has to do with the types of relationship you have with the spirits you're talking to. And I think that even a very dangerous spirit can be handled in a relatively safe way. And I think even the most minor elemental demon, and those are sort of the lower ones on the scale, they can cause lots of havoc if you're just messing around and if you invite that sort of thing. What I think is actually the most dangerous thing about the Ouija board is not talking to demons, which is what I spent almost all my time doing. The most dangerous thing we did was talk to John Cocteau, because he's a dead human. Dead people, ghosts, are dangerous. They are way more hurtful and malicious, and they tend to have way more of a negative impact on a person's life when they contact them. I think that demons actually, there's a process of how to deal with them, whereas with ghosts, there really isn't.
That's a good point. Tracy, we are almost out of time. I want to thank you for being on the program. Next time you talk to Clyde Lewis, tell him hi for me, would you?
Sure, no problem.
Okay, you be well. Clock Shavings, the name of the book, and Dabbling with the Dark Side. You know, we've got one of our guests, Karen Dahlman, great researcher, but she is very supportive of the Ouija board. She doesn't think if it's done right that it could backfire at all. And then we have someone like Tracy who dabbles with the dark side through the Ouija board. Ah, I don't think I'll do that. Up next, another couple hours of something very fascinating for you as we talk about The Last Rescue, how faith and love saved a Navy SEAL sniper.